We've been waiting for you. Come on in. It's Talk 10 Tuesday for April 9th, 2024 with Chuck Buck and Angela Comfort substituting for Dr. Erica Reamer. Lorraine Fernandez is with us today. She is immediate past president of the International Federation of Health Information Associations and the current communications chair for the organization. Lorraine helps us celebrate World Health Day. Lori Johnson has the latest coding news. Dr. James Kennedy reports live from Indianapolis at the National Conference of the Association of Clinical Documentation Specialists. And Angela Comfort will give us her point of view. Now here's the publisher of ICD-10 Monitor, the host of Talk 10 Tuesday, and the man who ate most of the Krispy Kreme Total Eclipse donuts yesterday, Chuck Buck.
Yeah, there was a hole in one of them. Thank you, Clark Anthony. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 593rd live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. And good morning, Angie.
Good morning, Chuck. Thank you for inviting me to be a co-host.
We're very delighted to have you here. But before I begin, I want to personally thank you, Angie, for sitting in today for Dr. Erica Reamer, but also next Tuesday as well. So thanks again.
Absolutely.
As you heard Clark announce, Lorraine Fernandez returns his broadcast. It was World Health Day on Sunday, as you know. And we asked her to be here today because we wanted to get her context and perspective and the relevance of World Health Day for all of us here in the United States.
I think that that's a fabulous topic, and I cannot wait to hear Lorraine.
So, Angie, what's the topic for your point of view today?
So my topic for today's point of view is personalized medicine revolution, how we code and document and get reimbursed in the genomic era.
Wow. Excellent topic, Angie. We look forward to hearing your point of view. We have a lot of news and reports, but we begin this morning with Dr. James Kennedy. He's substituting for Tim Powell, and Dr. Kennedy's reporting on news coming out of the ACTUS conference in Indianapolis. Dr. Kennedy, it's all yours.
Thank you so much, Chuck. Good morning, everybody. Welcome from the ACTUS convention in Indianapolis. We did get to see a total eclipse yesterday. So I think they announced that was compliments of ACTUS. But the total eclipse was 3 minutes in Indianapolis, and it was the site to be held. Well, the convention started, kicked off today. It's going on through Thursday. pretty good atmosphere here. The as I walk around, it's fairly well attended. It's got a good broad reach of clinical documentation integrity specialists. What probably, if there's any news to report, Lori Prescott, who's served as the interim director of ACTUS after Brian Murphy left, announced that she is transitioning to other opportunities. Deanne Wilk, who we know was the CDI director at Penn State in Hershey, will pick up a lot of her responsibilities along with Rebecca Hendon. So looks like it's going to be a tag team of both. So look for a little bit of change in that. A big call again for community within the ACTUS environment, recognizing there's different people of different persuasions, different approaches. Remember again that CDI is a partnership between the physician and the coder. So in the convention, there's a lot of emphasis upon clinical definitions. Sepsis is being talked about this morning. Malnutrition is being talked about. And such. So it seemed to be a pretty good meeting. If you are a member of ACTUS, after the convention is over, you can likely download the slides from the ACTUS website, acdis.org, and at least be able to see what's being put out there. Of course, the real chemistry that occurs here is the meetings after the meetings. Like last night, I was speaking to an anesthesiologist from New Orleans, and we talked about building a perioperative workflow in their hospital system down there and how anesthesia can help surgeons with their documentation. So if you look around, probably the big buzz of anything, the number one big buzz here is, again, going to be the role of technology in CDI. Remember, in CDI, it's processes, technology, and people. So once you get your processes in place, what technologies will help us accomplish our goal, given that there's an ever-expanding, just expanding need for CDI type principles. It's no longer just reimbursement, MSD or G, APRD or G. Lots of talk about patient safety indicators. And I think what the big aha is the fact that PSIs are risk adjusted using the Ehlichhauser model. I was speaking with some prominent systems in the Massachusetts area, and they were talking about how hard they're working and they couldn't get their PSI 4 better and blah, blah, blah. What we looked at is that we found that PSI 4 and the other PSIs are risk adjusted with the Ehlichhauser. And so I think that there was going to be one lecture here where they're talking about the star ratings with CMS mortality measures, CMS readmission measures, and the like. But I think that when we get down to technology, there's still we're trying to find our way as to what extent will the technology help us be more effective with what we're doing with the staffing levels that we have. One of the big myths that's being still out there is that will AI machine learning eliminate jobs for CDI? The answer is resoundingly no. It's just like, did the encoding software eliminate the need for coders? If I asked a coder if I could take away their encoder and they go back to books, they would fight me. I think that we're going to find that a properly programmed technology, which AI, whatever, will actually address many of the common issues that occur with CDI, but then will be so that we can get to the more complex areas. Other aspects, again, the chemistry that's occurring here at the ACTUS convention, I would say that in the booths, most of this is technology oriented. There's some staffing, that's going on. The sessions will be available to you from the ACDIS website. And Chuck, that's about all I've got from Indianapolis today.
Okay, Dr. Kennedy, thanks very much. That was Dr. James Kennedy. Dr. Kennedy is the president of CDI-MD in Nashville, Tennessee. Today it is Tuesday. It's April the 9th, 2024.
Lab Week is fast approaching, and we have an exclusive offer for you. In honor of Lab Week, we present you with a chance to win a free one-year subscription to the Laboratory All Access Pass. You heard it right. Unrestricted access to expert-driven laboratory resources available to you 24/7. This pass includes access to the Comprehensive Coding Essentials for Laboratories ebook, an annual Laboratory Coding Update webcast, and a monthly Laboratory Spotlight article, all curated to elevate your practice. To enter the drawing, sign up for a chance to win before April 12th. The lucky winner will be announced on Talk 10 Tuesday, April 16th. Visit the link included in the comments and in our podcast description to sign up and secure your opportunity to win. Don't miss out.
Now's the time for the Talk to Tuesday Coding Report with Lori Johnson. And good morning, Lori Johnson.
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning, Angie. And hello to our listeners. Last week, I started a series on developing facility-specific coding guidelines. This series is based on the AHIMA practice brief by the same name. This practice brief was updated in December of 2023. Your assignment last week was to talk to other departments and understand their data needs, as well as understanding what procedure codes will be assigned by the coders. Today, I want you to document in your guidelines how many diagnosis and procedure codes are the limit for coding. Another way to say this is, what is the maximum number of codes that can be assigned for diagnosis and procedure? You may need to consider if there are limitations by patient type, such as acute care inpatient, outpatient surgery, emergency department, skilled nursing facility, observation, etc. Continuing with procedure theme, do you use the X modifiers on outpatient surgery cases? Do you use them for specific payers only? Another procedure topic is the assignment of ICD-10 PCS codes on outpatient cases. Does your state require them or not?
document the use of unlisted CPT codes or inpatient-only CPT codes? Are there additional steps to be followed when these codes are assigned? Your guidelines should also specify which provider types may perform procedures: chiropractors, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, midwives, podiatrists, dentists, etc. Document where the coder may find bedside procedures, blood transfusion, dialysis, obstetrical procedures, again, etc. So let's look at some specific procedures. Computer and robotic procedures. If the robotic procedure is not part of the code description, does the coder assign another code? So would the coder assign S2900, or would that portion of the procedure come from the charge master? Is the rule the same for inpatient and outpatient? For interventional radiology and cardiology, do the inpatient coders assign both the radiology and the surgery portion of the interventional surgery? Do the outpatient coders only assign the surgery portion? Radiology procedures, do you assign codes for x-rays, CT scans, MRI, nuclear medicine, PET scans, ultrasounds? Are the expectations different for inpatient and outpatient? Neurology procedures. So we're looking at EEGs, video monitoring, intraoperative monitoring, EMGs. Which of these procedures, if any, do you assign codes to? Are there differences, again, based on patient type? Oncology procedures. Are chemotherapy and radiation therapy coded? Again, do the roles change based on patient type? How do you capture infusions, injections by patient type? Also consider midline, arterial lines, PIC catheter insertions. Are these coded or not? Rehabilitation procedures. Do any of your payer contracts pay by rehab DRGs? If so, you need to assign at least one physical therapy or occupational therapy procedure code for inpatients. Then we have newborn procedures, hearing tests, circumcisions, vaccinations, etc. Do you capture any of these procedures? Pregnancy and delivery procedures, insertion of the epidural catheter, artificial rupture of membranes, labor induction, fetal monitoring. Are you coding any of these procedures? Other procedures to consider include osteopathic manipulation therapy, or OMTs, chiropractic, detoxification, counseling, transfusions, CPR, and dialysis. Do you capture the first procedure, such as in dialysis where multiple may be done at an inpatient, or do you capture every single one? As you are writing your guidelines, create a column to identify what's the reasoning for capture. I always say that for everything that you code, you should have a reason for capturing it. For example, we capture midline catheters because the charge master is expecting a code for inpatients. Another reason could be that certain departments needs the data. This process of writing your facility-specific coding guidelines is worth the time and effort because it helps to make data consistent, and it also helps when you have new coders or contract staff coming on board. Back to you, Angie.
Thanks, Lori. That was Lori Johnson. Lori's a senior healthcare consultant for Revenue Cycle Solutions. Chuck?
Thanks, Angie, very much. And thank you again, Lori Johnson. We really look forward to part two in your series.
Let's celebrate World Health Day. To honor this year's theme, My Health, My Right, we're excited to present our webcast, 2024 SDOH Update, Navigating Coding and Screening Assessment, happening on May 22nd. Led by esteemed expert Tiffany Ferguson, this webcast will equip you with the latest insights on coding the social determinants of health. As part of our World Health Day celebration, we're offering this webcast at a special early bird rate of just $99. But hurry, This offer is available for a limited time only. Order by April 12th. And use coupon code WORLDHEALTH24 to claim your discount. Don't miss out on this chance to enhance your skills and contribute to improving healthcare outcomes. Visit the ICD-10 Monitor store to register and use code WORLDHEALTH24 at checkout to claim your discount.
We're celebrating World Health Day. World Health Day, of course, was Sunday. But to add context and perspective to World Health Day and its relevance to all of us, we've invited the past president of the International Federation of Health Information Associations, Lorraine Fernandez, to be with us today. Good morning, Lorraine.
Good morning, Chuck. And thank you for the invitation to share a few insights with you. April 7th was World Health Day. We probably didn't really celebrate it till Monday for those of us in the U.S., but the celebration should continue for weeks to come as the theme that the WHO established is one for the ages. My health, my right. I was really excited when I saw this. But there's some grim statistics that illustrate the status of health rights around the globe. At least 4.5 billion people, more than half of the world's population, are not fully covered by essential health services as of 2021. Something to ponder, sadly. The WHO core messages for the 2024 theme include: know your health rights, make decisions about your own health, protect your right to health as a basic human right, promote the right to health as an intrinsic pillar of our broader human rights, and champion health as a priority. Clearly, these resonate around the globe. I'm happy to share that WHO has developed policies and tools supporting the prudent use of artificial intelligence through information governance and ethics. And you'll see a lot of information on the WHO site. Their strategic vision for AI includes three pillars: enable, facilitate, and implement. Visit their website for details. As health information professionals, we are key resources to advancing global and domestic health, including health rights through privacy, security, and information governance, particularly in the use of AI. IFEMA, the association for which I am the immediate past president, and as Chuck shared, the communication chair, we've been around since 1968, and we enjoy official relations with the WHO for over 40 years. We fully subscribe to human rights, the theme, and health rights for today. We embrace high quality, timely, and interoperable health data in support of our mission, a healthy world enabled by quality health information. IFEMA is proud to champion global health through our members from 56 nations around the world, the U.S. obviously being one. We are always mindful of the importance of addressing the needs of our members from low and lower middle income countries, as defined by the World Bank. IFEMA takes actions to broaden the global remit through our initiatives, such as communities of practice that address education, research, and ICD-11. We have work groups addressing member engagement and growth, education, training, and research, and our strategic partnerships. We've published white papers and position statements addressing privacy, ICD-11, workforce training, and education. And last but not least, we had a grand Congress, as we call them, in Brisbane late October of last year. It was a roaring success. We all learned a lot and had a great time. No World Health Day would be complete without a mention of the importance of ICD-11 implementation. I'm glad you have Mary Stanfield frequently talk about ICD-11 with our other colleagues. We may chuckle a little in the U.S. because we were clearly one of the last to implement ICD-10. So ICD-11 is probably a decade or more away in my crystal ball, at least in the U.S. Massive training and change management will be obviously required for ICD-11, and that includes integration with EMR systems and assistive technologies. First and foremost, what are the use cases for the data that you're going to be collecting with ICD-11? Because the world is going to be very, very different with ICD-11. I have to give a big shout out to Mary Stanfield, Kathy Gianangelo, and Joanne Valerius for representing IFHMA at the various work groups that WHO has in their family of international classifications. If you're not an IFHMA member, or if you're interested in doing volunteer work with us or participating in our communities of practice, please reach out to me and I'll be happy to put you in touch with Marcy McDonald from Toronto, our membership chair, or the leaders of some of these COPs. So I close by saying, let's champion the health rights theme that WHO has established for World Health Day. We can do this through our personal actions and our professional goals. So I close saying, I've traveled the world for IFHMA, except during COVID, obviously, and in my professional roles. So let's take it a step further. From Northwest Montana to the Nashville area. Thank you, and over to Angie Comfort.
Thanks, Lorraine. That was fabulous information. And I know that several of the individuals watching are going to reach out to you just to find out how they can be part of those COPs. That was the communications chair and immediate past president of IFHMA, Lorraine Fernandez.
Every time we have a guest co-host, as we do today with Angie Comfort, we ask them to share a POV, a point of view. So here now with her point of view is our guest co-host, Angela Comfort. Angie, it's all yours.
Thank you, Chuck. Good morning, everyone. Today, we're going to dive into an exciting and transformative area of healthcare. The personalized medicine revolution, particularly how it intersects with coding, documentation, and reimbursement in the genomic era. Personalized medicine, also known as precision medicine, represents a paradigm shift from a one-size-fits-all approach to healthcare. It tailors treatment and prevention strategies to individual genetic profiles, lifestyles, and environment. At the heart of a personalized medicine, it leverages genomic data to understand the unique genetic makeup of every single patient. And this approach has already shown remarkable success in areas like oncology, where genetic information can dictate the most effective cancer treatments for a specific individual. Beyond oncology, it's paving the way for breakthroughs in rare diseases, pharmacogenomics, and I can't say the word right, and chronic conditions management. The goal is straightforward: to optimize health outcomes by ensuring that the right treatment is delivered to the right patient at the right time. With the rise of this type of personalized medicine, traditional coding systems are being stretched to their limits. The specificities of genomic data require a nuanced approach to coding not fully accommodated by our current ICD-10 or CPT codes. This gap underscores the need for an expanded coding framework that can accurately represent complexity of the genomic-based interventions. Furthermore, the dynamic nature of genomic research necessitates continuous updates to coding standards, posing a significant challenge for coders and healthcare professionals alike. Making sure that we are accurately documenting genomic data in the health records is another critical challenge. This documentation must not only support clinical decision-making, but also satisfy the requirements of insurance providers to ensure appropriate reimbursement. The complexity of genomic information requires sophisticated EHR systems and a deeper understanding among healthcare providers to ensure that this data is effectively captured and utilized. On the reimbursement front, payers are grappling with how to cover the costs of genomic testing and personalized treatments, which often come with high price tags, but the promise of better outcomes. As we navigate the genomic era, collaboration across the healthcare ecosystem is vital. This includes ongoing education for healthcare providers, coders, and insurers about the latest developments in genomics. Moreover, policymakers must work alongside our healthcare professionals in order to create supportive frameworks that recognize the value of personalized medicine. Embracing these changes will not only enhance patient care, but also pave the way for a more efficient, effective, and equitable healthcare system. The rise of personalized medicine and genomic data is not just a glimpse into the future of healthcare. It's a revolution happening now. By addressing these challenges in coding, documentation, and reimbursement, we can fully harness the power of this revolution to deliver unprecedented levels of care to our patients worldwide. Back to you, Chuck.
Wow. Thanks, Angie, very much. And be sure to read Angie's excellent article on that very topic. It's in today's ICD-10 Monitor. Angie, I wanted to circle back and I wanted to ask the group a question about ICD-11. So I keep hearing, yeah, maybe in this century, but anybody have more of an update on when the U.S. will be able to implement ICD-11 and actually use it?
You know, Chuck, a couple of weeks ago, I spoke a little bit about ICD-11. And as Lorraine said, we're looking at more than probably a decade with all of the intricate details of ICD-11, everything that will have to be done in the electronic health records, in payment systems. You know, Lori talked about taking coders back to the book and their encoders being pulled away. I am not sure how we're going to do anything in ICD-11 with the book, because what I've seen in years past was ICD-10 manuals were like, we had five of them and they were stacked this tall when we first printed them out for our task force. You can't print ICD-11. There's just no way. It's too involved. And I know that Lorraine mentioned some fabulous individuals who are working with different communities of practice on ICD-11 and with WHO. So I think that we're still long ways from it.
Thank you for your perspective on ICD-11, folks. I hope that answers your questions. And that is going to be a wrap for this, our 593rd live edition of Talk to Tuesday. I want to thank our panelists today. Lori Johnson, Dr. James Kennedy, who reported from ACTUS conference taking place today in Indianapolis. Lorraine Fernandez, who reported our lead story, and a very special thanks to my guest co-host this morning, Angela Cumbert. And until we meet again next Tuesday, I'm Chuck Clark, reporter for Talk to Tuesday and ICD-10 Monitor. Have a great week, everybody.
Talk 10 Tuesday is a production of ICD-10 Monitor.